This is Karen Lyle with Salesport Talk, and today I have in the studio with us Chris Childers. And Chris, you are a disabled sailor, but you have done so much with your career, and you're now the chair of the Sybil Sailors Program, and you're out there sailing with everyone else, and there's no difference on the water, is there?
No, my disability definitely is not the thing that is holding me back in any of the endeavors that I do.
So tell us a little bit about your background in sailing and some of the accomplishments you have. I know you've gone through the Panama Canal.
Yeah, I've been sailing since I was about 8 years old in coastal New Jersey. Started sailing a Sunfish, raced with Flying Scots with my dad for 12 years or so. Did some teaching of sailing as early as like when I was 16. Moved up to Vermont for college, taught up there, South Florida on the Gulf side. Moved out to San Francisco about 7 years ago. Been teaching out here at all sorts of places. And yeah, I was lucky enough a couple of years ago, I guess 3 years ago now, I got a ride on a real big, nice boat and got to go through the Panama Canal and up to New York City, out to Bermuda, did the Newport Bermuda race. Been pretty lucky with all the sailing I get to do.
So the Newport Bermuda race, we just covered that recently. Tell us a little bit about what that experience was like for you.
It was something that I was really, really looking forward to do regardless. And then I got a chance to get a job on this big boat, the Yacht America, a replica of the first boat that ever won what we now know as the America's Cup. So not only did I get to do the Newport to Bermuda race, but I got to do it on a 140-foot wooden schooner. Really, really incredible. Such a storied race, so much history, and I was just really lucky to be a part of it with my crew and a group of local Bermudians sailed with us, so we got to hear lots of cool stories about the race, and oh boy, the parties once you get there.
Oh, yes.
Else.
They're legendary.
Legendary.
Isn't that the reason that people race, is for the party at the end?
That's why we come.
That's right. And you want to know what the food and the drink is.
Yes.
That's why you get your sponsors. So what was your role on that particular race?
So I was working. That was my job. The Yacht America. I was just a crew member on the boat, so I was doing everything. I was sort of a watch captain. So, you know, when my shift came up at 4 a.m. and it was time to change the kite, it was time to do that. If we had to do some jibes or reduce sail, just sailing maneuvers. But then on top of that, we had a crew of guests. So I was also doing a little bit of hospitality, so like some charter yacht work there.
Excellent. I noticed that you like sailing for the opportunity to have those moments when you're just sitting there looking at the sunset.
Yeah, I sure do. I guess if that is there's a preponderance of those sunset photos on my Instagram. But yeah, that's a fun one.
So you're also we had Walt Ranieri here on the show as a blind sailor, and I guess you have been assigned. I guess they have three different positions in those blind match races, and you were the one who was the sighted position on that. Can you tell us how that works and how you worked with your team?
Yeah, definitely. So Walt is Walt does all kinds of sailing, and he is definitely a heavy hitter in the blind match racing world. What I participated in was blind fleet racing. And my job on that boat was a sighted guide. So there's four people on those boats when they race. There's a helmsman and a main trimmer, both of whom are visually impaired. Another sighted guide operates the jib and is not allowed to touch anything except the jib. And then there's another sighted guide who's not allowed to touch anything at all, and they have to talk the crew through their maneuvers. So that was me. I was sitting there sort of with my hands tied behind my back as I'm asking my crew to through this crossing situation and talking through a ducking situation on a starting line is a whole different ballgame when you know that your helmsman can't really see the starting line or the other guy. So it takes a lot of trust. I really like it because it improves my communication skills as far as racing and just coaching. So it was a blast to do that. We went to the Blind Fleet Sailing World Championships in 2015, and we were lucky enough to take fourth place.
That's amazing. Now, you are teaching all around the Bay Area. You've been here how long now?
I've been in the Bay Area for 7 years.
And you have you're going to be coaching for the Treasure Island Sybil Sailors Program.
Yeah, so I'm an employee of U.S. Sailing. I'm a coach for the Sybil Sailors Program. It's a cool new program from the Tom and Stacy Sybil Foundation. They donated a great sum of money to help us out, and they're starting this program in three different regions across the country. San Francisco Bay is one of them, Chicago, and the Mid-Atlantic are the others. So what I get to do is, sort of based out of Treasure Island, help out with a couple different community sailing centers around the bay. So Treasure Island is the primary center, but the Golden Gate Yacht Club Youth Sailing Foundation is also a supporting center, as well as the Alameda Community Sailing Center. So split my time between all three, and we're just looking to get more kids, more different stories out on the water, and try to figure out ways to keep them coming back.
We had Alex from the Golden Gate Yacht Club over here.
Alex is a good buddy.
Now, how does that program work with the sailing program that they have there at Golden Gate?
Yeah, so these programs are going to be sort of homegrown. We want them to be real organic. We don't want it to be U.S. Sailing, you know, calling out from Rhode Island about how the West Coast does its programs. So that's really what got me super excited about this. Right now, Golden Gate has a great number of programs for its club members, for its high school sailing. But because they have a great public access location, we thought that that would be an awesome place to put some boats, put some coaching resources with them, and see if we can get more kids from the city of San Francisco out for stuff like after-school programs or some fun stuff on the weekends, too.
Now, how does that work with Treasure Island? What's your has this program started yet?
Yeah, I'm in. I'm about a month in here. As an employee of U.S. Sailing, I'm kind of working all over the place. I've got a little desk at Treasure Island where I'm heading after this. I spend much of my time at Treasure Island, but this fall I'm spending a day a week at Golden Gate and then a day a week at Alameda as well. And that's going to change season to season as different centers' programs are changing. And then come springtime, we're going to be launching a couple of brand new programs at each center.
You know, I've noticed that in the sailing world, in the racing world especially, everybody knows everybody else. I mean, crews are changing on different boats and different combinations. And so you actually know most of the guests that we've had on the show, Malcolm Page and Alex and, yeah, and Walt and so forth. And what would you say is your experience of friendship in this community of sailing?
Yeah, you bring up a great point. You know, when I was 8, 10, 12, getting into sailing, you're meeting a lot of people. After about, you know, 20, 21 years old, the sailing world just gets smaller and smaller and smaller. I find anytime I go traveling, anywhere I go, I make a point to do a research about what are the different sailing clubs that I can find, maybe jump on a race boat where I can go. And inevitably, every single place I go, I find some friends of friends, and it ends up being just an unbelievable opportunity to meet people and shrink your horizons a little bit. Sailing is so cool like that.
Is there... And we're like at the last couple of minutes of the show. Is there anything that you have experienced on the water that just stands out in your mind as a momentous, life-changing experience?
Good one. I can remember a couple of sunsets when I was on the Yacht America. This was in 2016. We left from San Diego, sailed downwind to the Panama Canal, and then there's a good beam reach up from the canal to Florida and then to New York. We spent 24 days in transit from San Diego to New York City. We hit a nor'easter off of Virginia. Big 25-foot waves, cold water as soon as we got out of the Gulf Stream. We were sort of battered for a couple of days. And then sort of just as the storm was ending, we were rolling into New York Harbor. And the clouds were clearing, the sun poked out, and we came up on deck a little bit seasick, a little bit tired, hadn't slept, and right there is the Statue of Liberty, sort of like the sun shining just on it. That was sort of like a transcendental moment. We were, the other crew and I were just sort of bewildered, and it was, what must it have been like to, on a boat many, many years ago, to have seen that? It was really, really special. Felt like a part of history.
Thank you so much. This is Karen Lyle on Sailsport Talk with Chris Childers. And we're now going to our break. And, oh, another minute we have. Oh, cool.
Very cool.
So that means that we can talk for just a moment more.
Awesome.
So on your Treasure Island experience, are you also in communication with the Treasure Island sailing, U.S. sailing team, you know, the Olympic team?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, part of my new position is that we're looking to get the set the U.S. back up for, you know, further success in competitive sailing. So a little bit, we work very, very closely with all parts of the U.S. sailing organization, and that's certainly one of them.
And you and Malcolm have lunch together every once in a while?
Every once in a while, yeah. We had lunch the other day. It was really cool to catch up.
That little Treasure Island was the little cafe on Treasure Island, you know, over there where the World Exposition used to be in 1939 and 1940.
It's a really special place out there. Anybody who gets a chance, you know, it's not on the beaten path on your visit to San Francisco, but it's really neat.
I'm looking forward to the new development that they're going to have building out for the new housing. And I guess they're going to put the Treasure Island Museum.
Yeah, very much
there.
So. Yeah, it's changing so rapidly all the time. So it's so cool to just be out there and watch that change before your eyes.
I used to swim on Treasure Island.
Oh, cool.
I was on the swim team over at Piedmont, and then we would go rehearse on the 50-yard show. Okay, so this is Karen Lyle with Chris Childers on SailSport Talk, and we'll be back with you in just a moment.
This is Karen Lyle with a Treasure Island Museum Spotlight, brought to you in partnership with the Academy of Art University School of Multimedia Communications. Today's interview is with Thomas Kewen, who was a flight engineer on the Pan Am Clipper flying boats that took off from Treasure Island on their way to the Far East.
A seaplane named China Clipper made the first trip. The publicity for that flight caused all flying boats on that air route to become known popularly as China Clippers.
When a giant four-motor, 26-ton flying boat takes off...
Well, I was a flight engineer for Pan American. Basically, as an aeronautical engineer, and a licensed aircraft mechanic. And on the airplane, the pilots held the wheel and steered the airplanes, and the engineer operated the engines and the air conditioning systems, the electric systems. Sort of like the engineer on an ocean liner, same idea. But with a big four-engine airplane, there were so many complicated systems that the pilots didn't have time to fool with that. They just flew the airplane. And the engineer took care of the chores.
This China Clipper was the first of three Martin M130 four-engine flying boats built for Pan American Airways. It was used to inaugurate the first commercial trans-Pacific air service from San Francisco to Manila in November 1935.
My first trip to Hawaii was in August of 1943 on the China Clipper. It took 22 and a half hours to get from San Francisco to Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. 22 and a half hours. But we had a double crew, and we had some bunks where we could take a nap. But it was still a long, long ride.
The initial flight carried only airmail. Passenger service began in October 1936 with three Clippers. They flew from San Francisco Bay to Pearl Harbor, Midway Atoll, Wake Island, to Guam, and to Manila Bay. That took 6 days of approximately 60 hours of flying time at a cruising speed of 130 miles per hour.
For more information on the free lectures on Treasure Island, visit www.treasureislandmuseum.org. This is Karen Lyle with the Treasure Island Museum Spotlight.
This is Karen Lyle with SailSport Talk, And I still have Chris here in the studio. We've been chatting a little bit during our Treasure Island Museum Spotlight break. And Chris, we were talking about that swim from the South End.
It's from Alcatraz. They drive us out on a boat and then jump off and swim to shore.
So how was that? Now, you don't have like wetsuit or anything like that for it.
They give you an option, suits division or skins division. But, I've done a lot of swimming all my life, grew up at the beach, swim a lot at Ocean Beach here in San Francisco. So I thought, I had a friend who was doing it from work. So I thought, might as well. Sounds like a good time. But I thought I'd do skins division. So I did no wetsuit. And I also, because I'm only swimming with one leg, rather than swim in circles, I usually put a flipper on. But for this one, I did not. And so I swam from Alcatraz, no wetsuit, no fin.
Well, I used to swim on the swim team at the Piedmont in Piedmont. And then I would go to Treasure Island on the 50 meter pool that they had there.
Cool.
And we would do the practice where you have the little float between your legs so that you're not using your legs.
Yeah.
And, all arms. So if you're – how what's the dynamics for you when you're swimming?
Yeah, I'm definitely not doing your normal flutter kick. I kind of equate it more to like a butterfly kick with freestyle arms, kind of a body wave.
That works.
Yeah.
Yeah, that works. So tell me a little bit more about your own – favorite preference of boat? I mean, I imagine that any boat you're on is the one that you love, but can you kind of tell us a little bit about what you enjoy?
Yeah. I generally like to say my favorite boat is an OPB. Have you ever heard of it? It's other people's boats.
Right.
But my other favorite kind of boat, right now I own a Sonar, a 23-foot day sailing racing keelboat. And that ends up being sort of like my favorite kind of boat. Small, 1, 2, 3, 4 people. I love the new rocket ships too, asymmetrical spinnakers, all that stuff. But there's something about the old slow boats that require a great amount of teamwork. You got to be good at communication and all your maneuvers. And the skippers and crews are trying to eke out that extra little tenth of a knot. And at the same time, those same boats on certain days in San Francisco are good for taking your friends out.
Well, and we have a broadcast that goes to 82 to 100 million people in 168 to 173 countries in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so right now, the American Forces Network is listening to what you and I are talking about.
Very cool.
And all of those who are out there on the water know something about water and all the conditions with tides and currents and
yeah.
so forth. But not everybody knows about sailing because this is a sports show that Rick Tittle's been running for about 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he has been doing Monday through Friday, and he's just out today. So I get to be solo on this one. But this is something that if you were describing the experience of sailing a small boat versus, say, the America that you did in the race that we were just talking about,
mm-hmm.
what would you say are the experiential differences between those two?
Yeah, it's can be night and day, but let's see. I really like on the big boats, like I said, the communication, the teamwork, the better you get at communication and stuff like that, the better the whole boat runs. Then there's also something really special to be said about you're on your own boat and it's all up to you here. So like I got to do the Herb Meyer Regatta, I guess it was two weekends ago. And that was really special in a little single person boat, and everybody else is in their little single person boats. And it's up to you to make all the right decisions and all the right maneuvers.
Well, we just had someone join us in the studio, which is Morton Beebe, and I'm going to have him take your place. So, Morton, if you could come around and say hello to your fellow Treasure Island buddy here, Chris Childers, and then sit in the seat and take the microphone. We are really happy to have you, Morton.
Thanks so much, Karen. Welcome, Morton.
So Martin is a photographer and author, and he's explored the world. His experiences are so vast that it's a little bit it would take me the whole show that we have to talk to be able to tell about all the things that you've done, Morton. But you are a third-generation San Franciscan. You won't need the – you can just take the mic and put it right there in front of you.
Okay.
Okay, we're good. Say hello, Martin.
Good morning.
Now you are on the air and everybody can hear you. It is such a pleasure to have you here.
Well, thank you. Delighted to be here.
So you recently gave a lecture at the St. Francis Yacht Club about China. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience and what you were sharing?
Well, it's my second visit to China proper. I'd been to Beijing once before with a delegation of young kids who had, under the authority of Pat Matadon, she'd rounded up kids winning an essay contest, and we ended up in Beijing meeting with one of the leaders from northern China. So I'd seen Tiananmen Square back 30 years ago, but this time we traveled with National Geographic on their trip, which was from Beijing to Shanghai over a period of 3 weeks. So I ended up with a lot of photographic material.
Well, and when you visit somewhere, you share it with the world through your photographs.
Well, thank you. Yes.
And you have a long history with Antarctica. Can you tell us a little bit about that beginning with National Geographic?
Well, the curious way that I found my way to the Antarctic was that although I'd read about Shackleton and his exploits in the Antarctic, leading the British in exploration prior to Americans doing so, and Scott, I didn't think I'd find my way down there, but for the fact that I was asked when in the Navy as a young officer out of UC Berkeley and flight school, I was asked where would I like to be based, and I thought for a second, addressing this commander in Washington, I said South Seas. Little did I expect that he would interpret that as an open map and where I had Hawaii in mind or somewhere
warm,
island,
right?
Community, right. He said, oh, there's something special here. I'll confirm it when you get back to Florida where you're based in flight school. And lo and behold, I was shocked to get orders to Naval Supporting Forces Antarctica. So I spent a little over 2 years involved in going down to the ice out of New Zealand back in 1957, 58, 59. And I was down there with Admiral Dufect, who followed Admiral Byrd into the Antarctic for the U.S. And we ended up at one point flying up to the pole, which was nothing more than a tent holding 13 Seabees, trying to build a base there to meet Sir Vivian Fuchs and Edmund Hillary, who successfully made the first crossing in the Antarctic. And when you're up there, you're at 11,000 feet. Very cold.
Very cold.
Average daily temperature minus 60.
I can't even comprehend that.
But you get 24 hours of daylight in the summer and zero in the winter to start with. And the only drinking water you have is to use an ice pick, dig down into the ice and bring up blocks, and then oil heater melts it, and then you have something to wash your hands, face. Shower once a week.
Now, I understand that when you were there, that there was a National Geographic photographer who had to leave and gave you his equipment and contacts.
Well, he didn't give me cameras. I had a 35 camera at the time. He had a couple of them. One he sacrificed by dropping it out of an aircraft to try to get a shot of what a parachute equipment drop was, and he lost it. It was buried deep into the ice and snow. But when I arrived, we became reasonably good friends, and he had an early return from the ice back to Washington and left me with his film supplies and said, just send them back to National Geographic for processing. And in doing so, I then got all the busier photographing Fuchs, Hillary, and the final arrival of the cross-continent team. And that material, much to my shock and surprise, ended up as a cover of Geographic, National four other publications.
Well, that was certainly a good way to start your career.
Yeah. Being at the right place at the right time.
Sometimes you don't know that's going to happen, and you're just there, and all of a sudden you find yourself in the middle of something that you never guessed you would be.
Absolutely.
But you've really taken that opportunity and done some amazing things in your life with photography and traveling the world. Of all the different experiences that you've had, is there one that stands out as most especially memorable for you?
Well, I've always liked the tropics, so I've taken advantage of repeatedly heading out to Hawaii, to all the islands, and photographing everything I could think of there, short of moving to Hawaii. But I think Antarctica is the most exotic. I've made two trips, if not three, to Africa and worked with the Maasai and lived within the village and so forth.
Whereabouts were you in Africa?
In the Maasai Mara in Nairobi.
In Nairobi, yeah. I've been with the Maasai in Tanzania in the bush and sat in the tents with the flies and all the other things that you don't notice.
<nuts. laughs>
But an amazing people, the Maasai.
Gosh.
I have some good friends who are chiefs of tribes there in Tanzania, and I imagine have you maintained those friendships, or was it a little difficult without social media at that time?
Well, a little difficult, but yes, we've maintained it. We did an educational program trying to save the ancient Ma language, which isn't written,
right,
widely spoken,
mm-hmm,
by
Sopai,
the elders.
Sopai.
So anyway, we did some recordings, and with a school system out of the East Coast, they broadcasted the material. And it was supported by Discovery Magazine and the Explorers Club out of New York, which I've been a part of since about 1977. But in terms of other travels, I don't know. I've been everywhere but Greenland, I think, at this point. I'll get there one of these days.
Well, it's really great that you share your vision with all of us through your photography. And I've noticed that you have a special gift for composition. When you're in a particular situation, I know there are many things you consider, but what are two of the primary things that you consider when you're composing a photograph?
Well, they say it's a rule of threes.
Okay, I'll take three. That's good.
But it's a matter of, you know, composing quickly, mentally, three elements that make up a great composition, not just something centered in the center point of the frame, but to balance things like you would with three glasses of water.
I noticed there's always some little triangle somewhere, you know, mm-hmm, in your photographs, a little balance of those things, and I admire what you do very much with that. We have just another couple of minutes to talk about this, and I'd like to talk a little bit about your position as the Treasure Island Museum board member. What got you involved with Treasure Island?
Well, when I was 5 and then 6 years old, back in 1939-40, my parents took me to the fair, and I do have recall of some of the excitement of the huge extravaganza they had, where two trains met and they drove the Golden Spike on stage with cowboys and Indians and all. Wonderful pageant. And then there was great music, Benny Goodman and some of the great musicians, artists, and singers at the time, with a mammoth program. They had something like 24,000 people in attendance. And the whole architecture that was...
They built a whole milieu.
City.
Yes, yeah. A city there.
It was paradise as envisioned by the architects at the time. And it's too bad we only have one big building that remains where the museum will be ensconced.
Well, now I think we're coming to the close. Thank you so much, Mort, for coming on our show. This is Karen Lyle with SailSport Talk, and we'll see you again next Tuesday at 9:37 or a little before sometimes, like we did today. Thank you.
Not too long ago, it felt good to withdraw your cash from the bank, didn't it? For a vacation or a new car. But today, withdrawing your own cash has become risky. Pat Boone here for Swiss America. According to The Secret War, a new Swiss America white paper, I learned that all banks are now required to spy on you and me for the government, and then report any financial behavior deemed suspicious or unusual. You must read The Secret War. It's free. Truth is, I believe the government's new war against cash is really a war against us all. But the secret is now out. So please, get and read The Secret War.
Pick up your phone and call right now. 800-932-5517. 800-932-5517. 800-932-5517. Once again, that's 800-932-5517. Do you have a problem hearing the television? Do you need to crank up the volume so loud your family is screaming at you? Then put on your TV ears. TV Ears has helped millions of people just like you hear TV loud and clear without cranking up the volume. For about $60 with a 30-day free trial, you can get your own set of TV Ears. When you wear TV Ears, you can mute the TV volume for private listening or let others watch TV with you. Order in the next 10 minutes and take us up on our 30-day home trial and very special price. TV Ears is a brand hearing professionals have trusted for more than 20 years. And through this special radio offer, you can get your very own for just $60. Just mention promo code RADIO. So put on your TV Ears and make everyone happy.
800-984-4207. 800-984-4207. 800-984-4207. That's 800-984-4207.
Attention business owners. Now is the perfect time to start saving money on your cable TV bill for your business. We can give you packages with up to 90 great channels and save your business a ton of cash. And if you call right now, you can learn how to get free equipment and free installation. Now you have choices. It's time to start saving money on your cable TV bill for your business. And call today and get 90 channels plus free equipment and free installation. Smart business owners like you all across the country are consolidating and saving money on their cable TV, internet, and phone service for their business. So now's the perfect time. This may be a limited time offer to the first 100 people that call right now. So please save money and call now.
800-470-7113. 800-470-7113. 800-470-7113. That's 800-470-7113.
Oh, I would love that. And then maybe afterwards we can go field herping. That's when you go out and you look for reptiles.
Rick Tittle once threw a tennis ball at a donkey.
Oh, thank you very much for that. Welcome back into the show, closing down the hour. My thanks again to Karen Lyle and our guests, Morton Beebe and Chris Childers. Thank you so much for joining us on Salesport Talk. You can check that out every Tuesday. At Treasure Island in San Francisco, you know, I grew up in San Francisco, just outside of San Francisco. Treasure Island isn't always listed as one of those kind of places you need to stop at. I think it's very underrated. It's a lot of people just drive right by it as they take the bridge to get out of San Francisco. Check out Treasure Island. There's a lot more going on than what you think there.